Most historians consider Warren G. Harding among the worst presidents in American history. The popular image is of a lazy poker-playing philanderer who had no qualifications to be president except that he looked like one. His administration was stained by one of the nation's worst political scandals. And yet my guest today, John Dean, concludes that Harding was a far better president than the conventional wisdom allows. His new book, Warren G. Harding, is part of the American President series, edited by Arthur Schlesinger, Jr. John Dean served for 3 years as White House counsel in the Nixon administration. Mr. Dean, welcome.
Hello, Fred.
Harding is often labeled an accidental president, someone who was chosen as the nominee by a small group of politicians in a smoke-filled room in the 1920 Republican convention. And yet you suggest that that's not really the case, that Harding actively sought the presidency and had a strategy for getting nominated.
That's very true. In fact, just to correct one thing in your introduction, I must add that the scandals that plagued the Harding presidency all occurred after Warren Harding was dead. But Harding never learned about them, except in one exception we'll get to, I'm sure. They really happen after he's deceased, and he dies in office, of course. But to go back to your question on whether he's an accidental president, as some claim, we actually have a very good record of that. Harding's papers, which were long believed to have been destroyed by his wife, in fact, were not. His secretary had maintained them. In fact, many of them were taken to the basement of the White House and weren't discovered there until 1929 during the Hoover administration, and then they were shipped off to Marion, Ohio, where they sat unprocessed until 1964. They're now available, and I actually found a set of them up at Cal State Hayward, and I went through those, and one of the things that became very apparent, Fred, was that he was playing it very close to the chest, but yet he had a very clear strategy as to how he could become president. He thought that if the two front runners were likely to damage themselves enough, that he could become the compromise candidate. So he and his campaign manager, Harry Daugherty, set out with this strategy in mind, and indeed it played out perfectly. And some of the reasons that the so-called smoke-filled room myth started is because before even the convention had started, Daugherty made a sort of an off-the-cuff, he was a little bit peeved when he made it, and he said, well, you know, around 2 a.m. in the morning, a group of men are going to gather in a hotel room, and that's when they're going to select Warren Harding. Well, that's, in fact, what appeared to many to happen. In fact, it didn't. When the group got together to meet, when Harding was gathering strength, they were really trying to defeat him and not let him get the nomination and put their own player in rather than give it to Harding.
Whatever virtues Harding had, eloquence does not appear to have been one of them.
That depends upon the listener, I think. Obviously, H.L. Mencken didn't much like him or some of his political opponents, but one can go online today to the Library of Congress and play back Harding's speeches. Harding went into the studio with his friend Tom Edison, who had invented the recording device, and those have been preserved, and they're there, so one can judge for themselves on that.
There's one that you quote early on in your book where he's afflicted by almost fatal alliteration. Progression is not proclamation or palaver, it's not pretense or play on prejudice, etc., etc. It strikes me as being perfectly preposterous political prose.
Well, I actually, in my first draft, wrote an alliterative sentence that followed that, and my editor said, John, you better take that out. And I said, I agree. You've got to remember, this is pre-television, although Harding will be one of the first presidents to ever use the radio. But he had a lot of fun with his speeches, and audiences kind of enjoyed this.
During the presidential campaign in 1920, Harding called, in one of his most famous speeches, for a return to normalcy. What exactly did he mean by that?
Well, there have been a lot of interpretations of whether or not Harding actually used the word normalcy, whether a reporter had misquoted him when he had said normality, or whether he had misspoken. But whatever happened, the word got currency and seemed to resonate, and of course it's found in our dictionary today as a perfectly legitimate word. We had just been through World War I and a very horrendous fight in the Congress about whether or not the nation should join the League of Nations. There being very different opinions about that. The economy was in bad shape, the country was war-weary, and Harding's theme became, well, let's get back to normal. And he wasn't saying it in the traditional sort of let's turn back the clock sense. In fact, he makes it very clear when he delivers his inauguration address. When he talks about getting back to normal, it's with progress. One of the surprises to me And I don't really carry a brief for Harding. I was just curious because I'd grown up in the same hometown, found out more about the man. I found him surprisingly progressive. He really hadn't thought much about it and never thought about writing about him. But when I really got in there and started looking at this material, I said, this man is far more progressive as a Republican than a lot of people appreciate.
When he was running for president in 1920, many in the press were very unkind to him. Some thought he was a feeble candidate, utterly unqualified to be president. And yet he won a resounding victory, one of the most thorough trouncings of an opponent in American presidential history. What explains his popularity with the people who counted?
What do you say? The press didn't like him. The partisan press didn't like him. Most of the press actually was controlled by the Republicans in that era, and it was very favorable press. In fact, I can't think of any president or candidate who had a better relationship with working reporters. Harding, having been the founder of a newspaper and having worked as a reporter and worked as an editor his entire life and very successfully before he ever entered politics, really had a unique relationship with the working press, and they appreciated that. For example, when he ran the campaign from his so-called front porch in Marion, they built a little structure in the back of the house that he made for the newspaper men, and he would go out there regularly during the day and ask for a chew and have a very open exchange with the reporters, who had wonderful access to him, and then he'd either pitch horseshoes or with him for a little while. So he had this good working relationship. And also in his campaign, which was modern by today's standards, they actually had things like photo opportunities, which are very common today, where people would come through Marion, they would have a picture taken with Harding, and then the Harding campaign would distribute that picture to the local newspaper. Another thing that has long been argued is that he was afraid his managers wouldn't let him leave his front porch. And when I actually got into digging into that, I found that wasn't true either, that he had actually been fairly aggressive late in the campaign and going out around the country. He played well in the newspapers. He was highly photogenic, as you said in the introduction. He looked very presidential, and he was the right man for the time and won with a 60% of the vote.
You spoke earlier about his progressive policies. I think nowhere in your book was I struck more by that. Then on the issue of civil rights, he followed Woodrow Wilson, a man who presided over segregated Washington, D.C., who further segregated the federal workforce. And here comes Harding, opposing the lynching of African Americans, opposing within limits the segregation policies of his predecessor. And most strikingly, he goes to Birmingham, Alabama in 1921, into the belly of the beast, as it were, to proclaim the need for racial equality, leaving many of his white listeners stunned. This is an act of political courage, it seems.
Truly was. In fact, what becomes very apparent from Harding's papers is that he had very early a concept of bringing the South into the Republican Party, long before Richard Nixon would do it, for example. He just believed that there was a home in the South for the Republican Party, and had he lived and had a second term, and he certainly would have been elected to a second term, the scandals would not have affected him getting reelected. They didn't affect his vice president, as a matter of fact. But I don't think there's any question he would have further developed that. And it was very bold to go into the South while the audience was segregated. He just very flatly said, this isn't the way that we can live in this country. He also had very good rapport with black leaders. They obviously wanted more than he was able to give them. In fact, Wilson had somewhat stymied Harding on what he could do, because they had just introduced civil service, and what Wilson did before he left is he locked a lot of people into positions where a former president would have been able to make selections there and more blacks could have been appointed. Those jobs weren't available, but Harding did what he could.
You write in your book that no presidential action by Harding was more discerning nor longer lasting than his imposition of business practices on government. What exactly did he do?
Harding had been in the Senate during the Wilson administration. He'd served in the Senate since 1914, and then he runs in 1920. So he had watched the operations of the federal government, and one of the things that Wilson had rejected was a Bureau of the Budget, where the executive branch would coordinate and consolidate its budget making. The way it was before there was a Bureau of Budget, each department and agency would come to the Hill and seek separately what they wanted, and the Congress had to kind of figure this out. So there was very little physical control by the executive branch. There had been a proposal for a Bureau of the Budget that Wilson had vetoed. One of the first points of business that Harding felt had to be attended to was to put the executive branch on a business footing, and he did indeed just that. That was one of the first bills that would go through during his administration. Today, the presidency is much more of an activist, sort of creator of legislation, and Capitol Hill looks to 1600 Pennsylvania for ideas of what they should or should not be doing. Before the Roosevelt administration, presidents are not that active. Teddy Roosevelt was somewhat active, but still, the Congress is very active in deciding what to do. So Harding, however, is one of those presidents who starts believing, because he comes from the legislative branch, I've got to let the Congress do its thing and stay out of its business, and it'll stay out of my business. I will execute the laws and preside. But by the time he's there 3 years, he realizes, too, that the nature of the way the system should work is that he's got to be much more aggressive with Congress.
After Harding's death, a woman named Nan Britton wrote a book in which she claimed to have been Harding's mistress, claimed that he fathered her child, and that they sometimes carried on in White House closets. I guess the question is, did he have sex with that woman?
Well, I don't think he did in the White House, and I don't think he did at all. It's one of those things that today we can actually solve. As you know from reading the book, I put a rather lengthy footnote in about who was the purported daughter and where she might be today. Her name was Elizabeth Ann. She was raised in Chicago, get married, and actually moved to California. When I was working on the book, I tried to track her down, but I found myself playing detective and not getting on with the book, and so I finally just decided to put that footnote in. Before I published, I actually had gotten a tip as to where Elizabeth Ann might be, because there are lots of Hardings. Warren Harding was sterile, and he loved children. He would have been a wonderful father, and he was married to a woman who had been married before and had had a child, so we know that the problem was on his side. But yet his brothers and sisters had many children and offspring, so there are lots of Hardings out there, and Elizabeth Ann has had two sons and a couple daughters, and to make a long story short, I know where they all are now, and hopefully one day I can convince them to do some DNA testing, because I happen to think it's one of the great historical hoaxes what Nan Britton did. She wrote this book in 27, 4 years after Harding's death. Really, she couldn't even find a publisher, so it was sort of self-published. The book did nothing until H.L. Mencken reviewed it and said, hey, everybody should be reading this book, and then it sold 100,000 copies at $5 a copy, which is a big ticket item for a book in 1927, and it was a phenomenal sale. But what the book did do is it was the point at which Harding's reputation really starts to tank, because she does claim that she had sex with the president in the White House. But most of her contentions have been challenged. The head of the Secret Service agency said, this just isn't correct. The historian who's done the most in really debunking a lot of the myths is a fellow by the name of Robert Farrell, who did a wonderful job. And I didn't try to repeat all of his efforts, but I did do some digging, and I'm continuing to do some digging, because I've always thought that Harding got this terribly unfair rap.
The greatest black mark against Harding certainly has been the Teapot Dome scandal, which was, until Watergate, the great presidential scandal of the 20th century. I'm interested in your perspective on this, which is a unique one. You've written about Harding, and having served in the Nixon White House, you saw Watergate up close. How would you compare the two scandals?
Well, of course, Teapot Dome is the first time that we have the appointment by a president of a special counsel or special prosecutor. In fact, Coolidge selected two of them from both parties, because it wasn't clear where the scandal was going to go. And as a matter of fact, what's interesting about Teapot Dome, the heart of the scandal is that the government oil reserves, which had been placed in the Department of Navy, were transferred to the Department of Interior, and the Secretary of Interior, in turn, leased them on very favorable terms, and doing it under secret circumstances to people he had known in the oil business, and had accepted what he called loans and the special counsel would call bribes. The long and short of this is that, first of all, Harding has no knowledge of the money that comes to his Secretary of Interior fall. This all surfaces after he's dead. The reason it appears to me that Teapot Dome had the legs it did is, first, like Watergate, it had a very catchy title. Teapot Dome is the name of a rock formation that sits on top of a geological dome in Wyoming that had the oil under it, and that nickname, like Watergate, encompassed not only one event but many. In this instance, it was not only the lease of the oil in Wyoming, but the lease in a couple reserves in California as well, but all got under the label of Teapot Dome. So it had a catchy label, and also it went on forever. In late 1923, there were some preliminary hearings, and nothing really gets started. In fact, the first hearing on the matter, the committee can't even get a quorum present, but they will do that, and then slowly but surely it will come out as to what the facts are, and the special counsel will be appointed, and a number of congressional investigations will then start of everything to do with the Harding administration, and it becomes really one of the times when the Congress really flexes its muscle. And what's curious about it to me, and I still don't know the answer to this, is that the Republicans control the Congress, yet they assign the investigation. Initially, it's handled by a senator by the name of Walsh, who is a Democrat. And it appears to me that he got the assignment because nobody else in the committee wanted it. He was the low man on the totem pole, and he actually made something out of it. He was an able lawyer. He'd been a prosecutor before he went to the Senate, and he did some good digging, and he got some good breaks and tips, so he made something out of it. But yet it did initiate this whole number of years of investigation into the Harding administration. I can only believe, had Warren Harding lived, that he would have dealt with it as swiftly as he did with the one scandal he became aware of, which was taking kickbacks at the Veterans Administration, where the administrator had been selling all sorts of World War I surplus goods and getting a kickback on it. As soon as Harding got wind of it, while no one could prove it and the man denied it, when he kept doing it, despite Harding telling him not to, he fired him for insubordination. The myth that Harding died because of the stress of scandals just doesn't compute for me either. He's a man who's had a bad heart condition for years, and when he takes what was to be a restful trip west, it's not because he's worried about scandals. He's really launching his early campaign for re-election.
Well, Mr. Dean, thanks so much for visiting with us today.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with John Dean, the author of Warren G. Harding.
Gentlemen of the conference, the United States welcomes you with unselfish hands. The world demands a sober contemplation of the existing order and the realization that there can be no cure without sacrifice, not by one of us, but by all of us. I do not mean surrendered rights or narrowed freedom or denied aspirations or ignored national necessities. Our republic would no more ask for these than it would give. No pride need be humbled. No nationality submerged. But I would have emergence of minds committing all of us to less preparation for war and more enjoyment of fortunate peace.